When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Vernomatic Productions.
Are you ready?
Live from the Metal Mayhem Studios in Rochester, New York.
We are gold.
And heard around the world by metalheads just like you. This is Metal Mayhem ROC.
Heavy metal music.
Your weekly dose of metal music, interviews, album reviews, news, and more.
Want to be part of the show?
Send us a message through our website, metalmayhemroc.com, or hit us up on Facebook and Twitter.
Search Metal Mayhem ROC.
A proud member of the Pantheon podcast team.
It's getting nice and heavy.
Now, welcome our hosts, John the Vernomatic Verno, direct from New Jersey, Metal Walt, and from the band Motor Lord, Ian O'Rourke.
Good evening, everybody. As always, new content drops on Thursdays. Hey, I'm on vacation this week, but have no fear. Metal Walt, Ian O'Rourke, and Bill the Rager are here tonight, and they're going to bring you another installment of our kick-ass long-running series, The History of Metal. Tonight, the year 1995. Well, 1995, our usual suspects are still releasing stuff like Ozzy and Sabbath, AC/DC, Motorhead, Anthrax with John Bush, Iron Maiden with Blaze Bayley, Van Halen with Sammy Hagar. So, you know, that stuff's still going on. But by now, the gradual decline of grunge was taking place. A lot of the 80s hair metal bands were honestly on life support. And a new trend of industrial, dark, and heavy bands were coming around, like Fear Factory, Dark Tranquility, plus emerging bands that were really hard to categorize, like Monster Magnet and Primus. Perhaps you forgot about some of this. Maybe it'll re-energize you. Maybe it'll nauseate you. But at the very least, these guys are going to educate you and entertain you. So that's coming up in just a second. But first, want to remind you, if you're new to the show or haven't done it yet, get up to metalmayhemroc.com. Join our community by signing up for the email list. This is our way to alert you on new podcast shows, interviews on our YouTube channel, alerts for our live radio show that I host on Monday nights on Metal Devastation Radio. So there's tons of stuff going on up there. You could listen to past shows. Last week, we had David Ellefson from Megadeth fame. He was at the NAMM conference. He was telling us all about what's going on there. 2 weeks ago, Damian Collati, the filmmaker that brought us the Riot documentary, Jim Florentine before that. Beginning of the month, we had Saxon with a double dip with both Biff and Nigel, talking about the album, talking about the tour. So again, that's metalmayhemroc.com. Sign up for the newsletter. All right, that's about it. I'm going to get back to my cocktails and my vacation. But now let me bring you Metal Walt, Ian O'Rourke, and Bill the Rager for another installment of The History of Metal. For my co-host, I'm the Vernomatic. This is Metal Mayhem ROC.
On tonight's episode, I'm joined by Ian O'Rourke and Bill the Rager, our heavy metal experts and co-hosts of this episode of The History of Metal, our signature series talking about everything you'd want to know or maybe not want to know about any particular year in metal. So we're in the mid-90s now, right smack down the middle. Fold that piece of paper in half, and we're in 1995. So 1995 is filled with lots of good stuff, lots of stuff we might have forgotten about, and maybe some not so good stuff. So Hey, I was a 25-year-old kid in 1995. I was out of college. I was in my first job. I broke up with my college girlfriend. I was hitting the bars with my buddies and seeing metal shows all over the place. Life was good. What were you guys doing in 1995? Bill, what were you doing?
I was married, but living the life in Tampa and going to metal shows and jamming in a band. Yeah, having fun.
Ian, what about you? What were you doing in 1995?
Yeah, same thing. I mean, I had just gotten married in a band, you know, doing music and trying to have as much of a real life as I possibly could, you know. And, you know, the music was, you know, like you said, it was a little bit all over the place. There was a lot of great stuff. And then there was some stuff that was a little bit sketchy. You're kind of like, hey, you know, but it was that time, you know, it was that first post, you know, that big chunk of first post grunge music that was coming out, you know, and there was a lot of bands that were still kicking and screaming, trying to hold on to what happened in the 70s and 80s. And, you know, some of them did well, some of them didn't. So,
well, and that's exactly it, right? The last couple of episodes, we were so focused on the end of the 80s bands and the continuation of grunge. But now grunge is over, and now we're in this post-grunge world. And if you really look at, like, the list of albums or releases that came out in that particular year, it's still, like, it's a big, big list. There's a couple hundred of new releases that you can categorize as hard rock or metal, but it's very fragmented, right? Yeah. And let's start it off. Pick something. Let's get right into one of the albums.
Osmosis by Ozzy Osbourne. This to me is the last real good Ozzy album. I'm not even going to say great, because I think the last great Ozzy album was No More Tears. But I thought that this album was still really good. This was something that Ozzy was still a majorly relevant musician. Individual, the band, you know, at the time, where this was that, you know, he still was building into something, you know, huge. And this still had a lot of good stuff on it that was still getting not only radio play, you know, still struck a chord with a lot of the, you know, the rockers around, you know. I mean, you had kicked off with Perry Mason, but I mean, it had songs like Thunder Underground, which was like just this heavy brooding, you know, down-tuned, you know, monster. You know, and then you even had, you know, My Little Man, you know, Steve Vai doing his little guest appearance on there, you know, the one song that he worked on and wrote with Ozzy that he had performed on the album. So that's my starter right there. You know,
I personally didn't love this album. I think it's got points. Yeah. Never a fan, still not a fan of Perry Mason. Just the topic, Perry Mason for an Ozzy. Come on, Ozzy. And even his tours, when he was touring in this particular year, I felt like it was a bit of a letdown from, like, coming off No More Tears, because now Zach played on the album, but he was out of the band, and you had Joe Holmes on tour. Holmes. Joe Holmes was good,
but he was no Zach.
It just didn't seem the same. It was not. It was, to me, the beginning of the crappy Ozzy years.
Oh, yeah.
But
I kind of feel the same. I wasn't a huge fan of that record. I mean, I don't hate it, but it didn't knock my socks off. But, you know, there's some tunes I like, My Little Man, and I do like See You on the Other Side. I know that was a radio hit, but it was actually written by Lemmy. The lyrics were. So to me, that's pretty cool. Yeah. You know, it's a good tune.
Speaking of Lemmy, we had Motorhead. Right. Motorhead released Sacrifice. And this is what we were talking about last episode, was these were the years where you got a new Motorhead album every 16 months, 18 months. They were on every tour. They were on Ozfest. They were with Ozzy. They were with Black Sabbath. They were everywhere.
Like we had said before, this was that period of perpetual heavier Motorhead, if there is such a thing. It's a good album. It's got some really great songs on there, man.
It is a heavy album. Definitely. It's very heavy.
Yeah.
And they were also, you know, when they went out and toured, they became the three piece after that. So I think that lent itself to, like you guys, what we were saying, the sound of the band. You only had one guitar player go forward, right? Phil Campbell, you know, so you got to make simpler songs. There's maybe not as much just heavy, heavy riffs. And that was it. But the title track, Sex and Death, Over Your Shoulder, good stuff. Yeah. They play these songs on tour. Again, they're
Sex
not.
Sex and Death is a good song, man.
They, you know, they're not albums like you're going to go back and think about. But then when you go, Sacrifice, what was that? What year? Oh, yeah, there's two or three songs. I remember them playing and opening up for Sabbath. They played those. And it was good stuff. So that one, I think we all liked. Now,
Solid record.
I'm going to go back to the top of the alphabet. AC/DC. Bowl Breaker. Come on, guys. I mean,
it's a fun album, though.
The album title itself, Bowl Breaker. Yeah. Phil Rudd's back in the band. They came off the biggest point of their career, maybe, you know, with coming off the Razor's Edge. And they put out a stellar album, man. Fucking cool album title. Great cover. Good songs. Awesome tour. I mean, what else the hell could you ask for, right? Hard as a Rock, Cover You in Oil, The Boogeyman. Good shit, man.
And this was, you know, that period as well where they released the big live album, you know, the big double live that they had, 91, I think it was, 92. And then, you know, they still continued to put out really good stuff, but then it also hit a wall. You know, like afterwards, it was like, okay, you know, when we get down the road, you know, it's like, all right, yeah, it's AC/DC, but I don't really, you know, you don't hate it because it's AC/DC, but, you know, you didn't really care for it. But this was probably one of the last few that was really, it was still really solid. You know, this is almost like that fly on the wall. It's cool to like because it's such a good rocker. But like, you know, there's, you know, one or two singles off it that, you know, versus every other album that they ever did before that. So good album.
Then they had something to talk about with Phil Rudd. I mean, it's been, was it, 10 years, maybe more since he was in the band. They got out on the tour. Yeah. And I also remember, too, seeing this a couple times, once in Jersey and once at Jones Beach in New York. And I remember it was also a weird time for AC/DC where they were still playing big places, but the ticket sales were starting to decline a little bit. And you're right, Ian. I remember I think they toured in the year 2000. I can't remember what album that was, but I remember seeing them at the Meadowlands in New Jersey. And, you know, there was a lot of empty seats in the upper tier. Yeah. Something you couldn't even imagine now in 2023. Bill, I'm going to put you on the spot, a little tester. Oh. Anthrax, Stomp 442.
You know, honestly, I like this record, but it's a hard listen for me nowadays all the way through.
Why is that?
It's the production's kind of basic. I don't know. And but I really like the song Fueled, but to listen to the whole album, I don't think I could do it.
You're right, Bill. I mean, the production side of it is a little different, but it's, you know, something happened. Sound of White Noise, fucking banger, you know, but it was still different, you know, even the production side of it. When I got to this album, it kind of kept that same momentum with the writing, but there was something still a little bit different with it.
But it was almost like a sophomore slump, and I wouldn't even say like a slump. But I think it was the Sound of White Noise was such hot news at the time. Oh, and they toured for 2 years. Everybody, they were opening with everybody, playing with everybody. And it was almost like you almost needed a little break. And they came right back at this one. It was almost like you're not going to top it. So it became a little bit of a disappointment. Yet it wasn't really the music because, you know, the random acts of senseless violence, that opened the album Fueled, King Size, Riding Shotgun, that's good shit, right? But you're right, Bill. It's not an album you're going to reach to when you're going to grab a John Bush or a Anthrax album. This just isn't.
Right. Yeah. Now, I did see him on that tour. I believe they toured with Cannibal Corpse and the Misfits. I don't know if you guys saw that tour. That was quite a different lineup, but that was cool. And they only played like a couple tunes off that album, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Wow, that must have been a trip, though. Cannibal Corpse and Anthrax on the same bill. That must have been nuts.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
Let's talk about A Small Deadly Space by the band Fight. I know that you and I have an affinity for Fight, and I'm sure that Bill has to love Fight because the heavy factor is quadrupled when Rob Halford joins Fight. What do you remember most about that album?
Well, for me, this to me was, I don't have the same memories of this album as the first Fight album, War Words. I think it was another parallel to Anthrax. I was so into War Words when this one came out, I was excited, but I just remember it didn't blow me away like the first album did, and it's quirky, it's a little bit. You know,
it's got some different stuff to it.
Different stuff to it. And even when we interviewed J.J. Brown a couple months ago, even he mentioned this. He's like, it's good, but He said it was a weird period for those guys writing. He said Rob did a lot of the writing on his own, and he brought the material in, and it was a little hard for these guys to connect to it. And, you know, it was like one of those things, too, is like next thing you know, the album's out there on tour, and then the band's over.
Yeah.
So it also it reminds me also of a period where Fight was so short-lived, and this was just the end of it to me. So therefore, in my opinion, it doesn't hold up. What'd you think of it, Bill?
Yeah, same thing. You know, same as the Anthrax. The production on it is sort of loose. And I think that right away kind of was disappointing. And the songs aren't as memorable to me. I just don't, they don't stick in craw like War of Words.
They tried making that radio song blow out in the radio room. I remember seeing it on whatever was left of MTV at that time. And I was like, it's like kind of trippy, you know, but overly melodic song. I'm like, it's just not doing it for me. You know, it's good effort, but just wasn't doing it for me.
I got to say, though, that the title track, Small Deadly Space, I think is a killer
song. Oh, yeah, that riff at the beginning.
It's the riff is, oh, my God. You know, and then him at the end, Small Deadly Space. It's like,
There's good stuff in there.
There's good tunes.
It's not stuck in my head forever since hearing that.
All right, well, that's good.
Yeah. So, all right. I wanted to get anybody's opinion on the last Alice in Chains album, Alice in Chains with the late Layne Staley. I listed it as an honorable mention. There's a couple oddball ones in there, but this is the one with the three-legged dog on the cover. Yep. Had Sludge Factory and stuff on there. Bill, you got any memories of this album?
Yeah, I mean, it's, again, it's definitely not my favorite album. It's a great album, but it's not up to par with Dirt. I mean, Dirt to me was just phenomenal. Oh,
yeah. That's on godlike level. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And you could tell Layne was in his death throes. You know, you could tell his voice wasn't as strong, and he wasn't all there.
Yeah.
It was Jerry Cantrell was definitely leading the charge on that way.
Yep. I don't think they toured on this album too. I think they were kind of done on that, but you're right. I think he was too messed up, but you're right. Yep. The song Grind, Sludge Factory, super heavy. I mean, they get more radio hits. Heaven Beside You again.
Yeah.
You still hear those on radio now. Like, so, you got four or five songs. You're still out there playing. And the current Alice in Chains are playing all this material.
But if you go back and you listen to it, you know, which is something that I did not long ago, I think aside from Layne being in his addiction issues, I know that there was problems with some of the other guys in the band, maybe not as severe as Layne, but you can hear it. Like the songwriting is like, okay, it's kind of got the Alice in Chains edge, but it was kind of like, maybe this was a leftover from something, or like they had started it and they couldn't come up with an idea. And they're like, why don't we pull out that one and see if we can do something with it? It wasn't as strong. Even when Alice in Chains came back out later on with William, whatever his name is.
Yeah.
That first album, you know, that was like, oh, it's like almost like a rebirth of Alice in Chains. It was heavy as fuck. You know, it was really good music, but you know, I didn't think it was a terrible album, but you know,
on the other hand, Mad Season, I think, is a phenomenal album.
Mad Season is a good album. You know, and it's so weird, the dichotomy between hearing Layne on that last Alice in Chains, but you hear him on the Mad Season album.
Now, what makes it a great album, Bill? You say, what makes it a great album? Is it the Mike McCready factor? What makes it great?
Yes. I mean, his guitar tones on that album are just awesome. I mean, it's weird because it's more of a subtle, you could tell it's not a huge production. It's pretty basic. It's just a great album. It's very deep as far as Layne goes. You could tell he was hurting, and that was his expression.
Big time. Yeah, I can agree with that, but I think that what I liked about it was the mood. The album itself, you know, certain albums have a mood, and you can tell it's dark, but it's like fluffy dark. I don't even know how to describe it. You know, it's right. not
There's
like
a lot
something,
of melody.
Yeah, it's the, not the, something the, that's going to, you know, tear your eyeball out, but it's something that, you know, you're like, wow, you know, and then you sit back and you're like, holy shit. You know, I mean, this guy's really got some demons that he's been working through. So.
Well, and then the interesting things when it comes to commercial viability, you had singles off the Alice in Chains being played on the radio, and then you had River of Deceit, which was just as big of a single. And that one, it was almost a little confusing because, like, I mean, unless you really knew about it, you're like, well, that's Layne Staley, but it's not Alice in Chains. It's Mad Season. Who's Mad Season? You know, it's like it was that kind of confusion, but they were all being played on the radio at the same time.
I remember being confused by that when River of Deceit first came out. I was like, wait a minute, what's going on here?
Yeah.
You know,
the point I was going to say is you can hear how that song wouldn't be out of place on an album like Dirt, though. That could have been one of the more melodic, radio friendly songs on Dirt. It's got that same kind of vibe to it. You know, it's not, you know. And that's why I'm thinking, geez, like, what, they have a B-side that, you know, nobody knew about, you know, and then you find out it's another band. So,
well, I remember first hearing that song and thinking, it's kind of weak. You know, I didn't really listen to it. I was just hearing the guitar. It's kind of jangly and whatever and soft, very, you know, but then one time I really listened to it and I'm like, damn, that's a good tune. That's a really good song. You know, the vocals, the lyrics, everything. It's a great tune.
Well, I think one of the albums I know we all agree is going to be a top one from 95 is the debut from Down, Supergroup Down.
Oh, you had to do it now. Oh, God.
Well, listen, you know what? We're just going to randomly pick albums and cover all of them. Doesn't need to be in an order.
That's fine. Yeah, do it.
But guys, I remember this one was another one, you know, Stone the Crow just started getting played on the radio. And I'm like, what? This is Phil Anselmo, but it's not Pantera and it's Pepper Keenan and like what? Like Rex Brown? And who the hell is this? Down, it's not Pantera. Like, who are these guys? You had to do your research again. It was another Mad Season thing, a side project, you know?
Yep.
But that album is just, I mean, all the way through. Fucking Bury Me in Smoke, you know, Lifer, you know, All Hail the Leaf or whatever that song is. Just fucking great, great album. All the way through. Probably the top album of 95, if you had to pick
huge.
One.
I think Bill will agree with me that this is one of those albums you start, listen to it all the way through, start it again. You know, it's just, it's that kind of album, you know, and having that collection of guys. You got Phil from Pantera, you got Pepper from COC, you got Kirk from Crowbar. Todd Strange was playing bass on the time was in Crowbar or between him and Kirk, and then Jimmy Bauer from I Hate God on drums. If that is like the epitome, the only other super group that I ever think is above them is Bad Company. And it's only because they got the legs, you know, but Down is getting right there with them now because of the amount of time they've been around.
But what was it, guys? What was it? Because Down had a sound. It had a sound and it wasn't, it was Phil Anselmo, but it wasn't Phil Anselmo in Pantera, but it had more the elements of, and it was a little COC, but you're right, Bill, talk about the Dirty South. What was the sound?
It's just a kind of for lack of a better word, a grungy, grimy, just dirty sound. It's heavy, loud. And that's the thing. You have to play that out loud. You can't just listen to it like, you know, quiet. You got to crank that thing.
Well, and that's why the album's named NOLA, right? Yeah, so perfect analogy. It's swampy. It's from the South. It's from New Orleans, right? That's why they made it down there, right?
They were the epitome, you know, all those bands, I Hate God and Crowbar, they all wanted to call them sludge. Well, these guys were like, those bands are great, but Down as a collective is probably one of the top dogs in that category with those bands because they're so musical in what they do, but it's that amalgamation of like, let's take some Lynyrd Skynyrd and some Black Sabbath, and we're going to throw a little bit of, you know, I don't know, some new wave of British heavy metal somewhere in the middle, and boom, there you go. We got Down. I mean, it works magically. It's just it's a great album. And there's not a bad song, like you said, Walt, on this album. from beginning to end, you listen through to it and you're like, God damn, I wish I could write something like that. You know, I mean, who, where did those ideas come from? But it was, you know, years of jamming to being buds. So
and just well, just for to check the record here, this is the second sludge reference on this episode, right? We talked Sludge Factory and now we're talking sludge the sludgy sound. Now here, I'm going to throw you guys one. Talk about sludge. Talk about falling down headfirst into the mud. Iron Maiden, the X Factor.
Oh,
Bill, what'd you think of that one?
You know, honestly, when I listen to it again, it's not as bad as it was originally, but it, I just don't understand how they picked, what's his name?
Blaze Bailey.
Yeah.
It just, I don't know.
It's a British respect thing. Wolfsbane was same neck of the woods. It was an easy fit. They go to the pub. Yeah. You don't need to rehearse seven guys. You pick the first guy that you get drunk with and he's in and he's from your neighborhood.
Kind of like Yannick. Why do they still have Yannick in the band?
Isn't that what happened with Ian Gillan joining Sabbath back in the day too? They all just kind of got drunk together. Yes.
But that's a far better record if you ask me.
Oh, absolutely.
Born again. Jeez.
Well, when we talked about this album on our Replacement Singers episode, I think you and I and Vince agreed it's got, you know, the maybe the first three or four tracks are solid. And the band obviously loves this material because they still play Sign of the Cross today in the current tours, you know, but it was also the beginning of their lengthy, long 6, 7, 8, 9 minute songs that continue to this day. And I love Maiden, but you know what? There's not been a great album. Let's be honest. There's been good albums, but those long songs and double albums and playing clubs on this tour.
Right.
Small little places, 607 seat clubs. I saw them at the Birchill in New Jersey.
You
a tiny club. It, you know, Bill, you know the Birchill. Like, come on, man. I mean, A, it was small, but it was so small it was uncomfortable because it was overcrowded and it just wasn't a fun night. It's Maiden, but come on, man.
And they played Orlando on that tour, but it sold out. And I didn't even bother trying to get a ticket. You know, I mean, I was like, man, why did they play that place? But at the time, they knew they couldn't sell arenas or even small theaters. So,
but I think Walt, you had mentioned they didn't tour for very long either.
No.
It was a short tour because they couldn't get any ticket sales. So they were probably losing money. You know, trying to put that thing together. So it's like, screw it. We're not even going to do it. But I think we can all agree that one's not one of the top dogs of 1990.
Now, speaking of dogs, Bill, you've been, we've been patiently waiting for you to give up your top three or four of your favorites on the heavier side. Mm. So this is your chance, buddy. Go ahead. Let's hear what you
all
got.
Right. Well, first of all, there was a lot of killer heavy records that came out that year. At the Gate, Slaughter of the Soul, Suffocation, Pierce from Within, which, by the way, Dave Culross from Rochester, New York, played drums on that album. Death Symbolic, Dissection, Storm of the Lights, Bane, Deicide, Once Upon a Cross. I mean, there was tons of killer heavy records. But I'm going to talk about Fear Factory, Demanufacture. That was a great album. It was their second album. And there's some killer tunes on there. It's you know, it's funny because people considered them death metal when they first came out, but they really weren't. They're more, I don't know, cyborg metal, I guess.
Yeah.
And on this album, they had a lot of sequencing and sound effects and whatnot. And it's very, the album's about man versus machine. So it's very futuristic kind of sounding. But my favorite part of that album is the drummer, Raymond Herrera. He is just a monster. The guy was like a drum machine, but a human drum machine.
Sounds like a typewriter at times.
He does.
That double kick,
And a lot of people accused him of using using a drum machine, and he didn't. It was, he had triggers on his kick drums, but he was actually playing. I mean, I've watched a guy. I sat right behind him one time, and he wore heavy-duty, like, logger boots at the time too. He was playing all that stuff with these big ass boots on.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Dude is an amazing drummer, but there's some killer tunes on there. Self-Bias, Resistor, Replica, Dog Body Day, Surprise. I don't know if you remember that. So it was a cover song from Head of David. I don't remember who Head of David is, but that's a great tune, the Dog Day Sunrise. And I got the deluxe edition that had a couple cover tunes on there. Your Mistake from Agnostic Front, sick tune.
Oh wow, yeah, that's nice. That's good.
And then they had some remixes on there too. But that's another album. You play it loud, play it on a good stereo, it sounds amazing.
Now, I got to ask you, Bill, do you remember when they did remanufacture?
Because yes.
I did not care for that album.
No,
after,
me neither.
After listening to Demanufacture, I was not a fan of remanufacture at all.
Yeah, neither was I.
Yeah.
It was a little too industrial for me.
Yep. Yeah, I got a second on because I mean, you know, this is a great album and it's dark in like a it's H.R. Geiger, you know.
Yeah.
It always makes me think of that, you know, a cross between that and then like some kind of trippy 90s gothic, you know, vampire movie kind of thing. You know, it's got that atmosphere to it. You know, it's very brooding and haunting, but it's an intense heavy album. And
yeah, very intense.
Death Symbolic, man. Heavy, brutal, but so good. It's just all over the place, man. You know, yes. Schuldiger was a monster on that album. Great album.
I actually met him in the studio on that when he was recording that album.
Really? That's badass.
Yep. Very nice guy. Very nice guy.
Bill, just real quick, you wanted to give a nod to a particular album you missed discussing it before.
I missed it because of time restraints, but Cannibal Corpse, The Bleeding, and that was that's another sick album from the 90s. And I was actually in the studio when they were recording that, and that's when I met Chuck. And great album. I mean, say what you want about Chris Barnes, but the music was phenomenal. And I mean, it has Fucked with a Knife and Strip Draped and Strangled. And my favorite's Pulverized. That song is just killer. There's a really good guitar breakdown part in that song, and it's just sick.
Yeah, I remember that album. That was my first introduction to that kind of heavy. I was like, wow.
Well, if you remember, they were in Ace Ventura's Pet Detective when that album came out.
That's right. Yep.
Yep.
That's right.
Everybody remembers that movie.
So, that's Bill, cool. You had a couple of others. So let's hear about your other favorites.
Oh, yes. And then also I wanted to talk about Flotsam and Jetsam Drift. That's an album that when it came out, it was so different from what they'd done before because they're a thrash band, you know, and you expect those thrashy kind of riffs.
Sure.
And I remember hearing it when it came out and I was like, man, what the hell is this? You know? And so I didn't get into it. And I even saw them on that tour. I saw them. It was Megadeth, Fear Factory, Korn, and Flotsam and Jetsam. I don't know if it was in that order, but yeah. And then, by the way, at that show, I was backstage with the Fear Factory guys, and we were smoking a joint, and in comes Dave Mustaine, and he's like, guys, come on, man. He goes, I told you guys, you can't be smoking weed back here. So we kind of got scolded by him. He didn't yell at us, but he was definitely miffed because he was in his sober stage at the time.
It's too bad.
So, but anyway, Drift, man. I don't know if you guys got into that album at all, but it's a really good record. I got into it years later, and it's definitely different. It's more straight ahead. I don't want to say rock because it's not rock. It's still metal. It's just they're not. You know, the riffs are different, and the songs are big and open, and Eric A.K.'s vocals are just phenomenal.
Well, they had like that. It was almost like a two album stretch there, you know, their prior album as well was that same way. It was almost like their approach to what was going on, their adjustment at the time.
Right. And it was adjustment basically, just like Metal Church with, oh God, what was it? The album that came out before. I can't think of the name Darkness? Of it. Jeez.
No. Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Some balance. Oh God, I can't think right now. Anyway, back to the to Flotsam and Jetsam. Yeah. The song Me, Pick a Window, 12-year-old boy with a gun, or 12-year-old with a gun and Smoked Out. Those are phenomenal tunes, if you ask me.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know if you're familiar with those, but good tunes.
We discussed off camera. I had gone back afterwards and checked that out too. All these bands at one point or another, you know, you kind of circle back to try to check out stuff that you might have missed. And Drift was one of the albums. It's overall, it's a pretty freaking solid album. You know, I mean, it's
Hanging in the Balance, Metal Church.
That's Hanging in the Balance. There it is. Good. But.
And it's a very similar record to Drift. I mean, in the way their approach changed, because Metal Church was kind of a thrash band. You know, they had thrashy tunes and they changed up their guitar sound, I guess, is more or less what it was.
Yeah.
Well, Bill, we're going to take a short break. And we're going to come back. We want to hear about another favorite of yours from 1995. And then we got a lot more material to go because I have my favorite list. And then we have some of the top albums. And we're going to talk a little about, let's not forget our brothers of the 80s.
Metal Mayhem ROC.
Metal. I'm Metalhead.
Metal Mayhem ROC is the home for metal from the very beginnings.
This is James DeBert from Hellstar. You're listening to Vernomatic.
Dave Overkill from the Cleveland band Destructor. Hey, Dave, how are you?
I'm doing great.
To longtime headliners.
Hey, this is Red Beach from Whitesnake.
Hey, this is Vinny Appice from Dio, Black Sabbath, and Last in Line.
To music of today.
Hi, this is Olaf Wikstrand from Enforcer.
Hi, this is Brian from Mastodon.
You're listening to Metal Mayhem ROC.
With John the Vernomatic Verno.
Plus, we talk with producers and authors to give you behind-the-scenes info.
Hi, this is William Irwin, author of The Meaning of Metallica, Ride the Lyrics.
Greg Renoff, the author of the book Van Halen Rising, and the Ted Templeman book, A Platinum Producer's Life in Music.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Metal Mayhem ROC.
A proud member of the Pantheon podcast team.
Giving you more to listen for. Join our community. And always remember to keep it heavy.
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has three pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house, and my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with two devices at once. New quick charge function, three customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of Scary Guys, Skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
This is Metal Walt, and I'm with my metal brothers, Ian O'Rourke and Bill the Rager. And we're here dissecting the heavy metal year 1995. Guys, we have a lot more to cover in the remaining part of this episode. So, Bill, you're going to talk about Dark Tranquillity.
Yes, Dark Tranquillity, The Gallery. Sick album. A lot of people, for some reason, seem to like At the Gate, Slaughter of the Soul more, but I love this album. This album, to me, was their tops. But anyway, it was their second album, and the first for the singer, Michael Stein, I don't know how you pronounce his last name, but anyway, he was the guitar player, but he took over for vocals on this album. To describe it for anyone that doesn't know, it's a Swedish metal. You know, it's kind of got black metal elements to it, a little death metal, but it's not really one or either. It's definitely Swedish metal. Yeah. And a lot of killer guitar harmonies and brutal vocals. And actually, there is a couple tunes where they have a chick singing, and I can't remember her name, but it's very melodic, adds a good element to the record. And they went on to do some much lighter stuff afterwards, but it was, you know, a lot of people, it expanded their audience, but they alienated a lot of their earlier followers, including myself. And nowadays they're back. They just pretty much just do their brutal stuff. I mean, the last time I saw them, they were heavier than hell.
No shit.
Although the singer is the only original remaining member from those days, but they're still great live.
Seems to be the pattern. No.
Yeah. Right.
Well, going from completely dark, heavy bands, let's go to the other direction. Let's go back to the Sunset Strip at Bright Colors and Neon in the 80s bands. Now, listen, I'm going to be honest, guys. You know what? I looked at the roster of albums that came out in 95. Dokken, Firehouse, Warrant, Extreme, Kix, Skid Row, Malmsteen. Right down the line, maybe aside from Skid Row, Subhuman Race, I don't even remember any of these other albums, let alone remember a song, let alone remember a title. So I, you know what? It's maybe I'll take some blame here, but I must have checked out at this period of time, or maybe it was a byproduct of just not good material. So
no, Ian, I agree. I checked out too. I was totally checked out at that time.
But here you go. It's like still, I just named 8-10 bands. I think Warrant was another one. Like, you know, there's like they're putting new material out, guys, but nothing stuck from this period. I mean, what's a song off Subhuman Race that anybody knows? And that's the only one album I do know.
The song Subhuman Race is actually pretty good.
Okay.
Listen, that's probably the heaviest out of this group of stuff. I actually had to force myself to go back because I was never a huge Warrant fan. But I wanted to see what Ultraphobic was all about. And to listen back to it after the fact, it's not terrible.
Yeah.
It definitely sounds like those 80s bands trying to fit in with the 90s. You know, I think it was the last with Janie Lane. Dysfunctional by Dokken. I have a sensitive spot for this because I saw this tour. Saw them at the Lost Horizon in Syracuse.
Wow.
Too High to Fly was the first single that they had off the album. And Mick Brown came out, was the only guy to come out of the tour bus, beers in hand, saying hi, shaking hands, taking pictures with everybody that was waiting outside that tour bus just for a minute to say hi. You know, I mean, just about everybody that was in the club wanted to try to meet the band. They were all people of a certain age, our age. You know, and they wanted to freaking meet these guys. And you could see George and Don and, you know, obviously they probably were still having a pissing contest with each other. They'd look out the curtain. They go back. Mick walks right out. He's like, F this, comes out. What's up, everybody? I mean, he was the greatest guy.
I miss Mick Brown. I miss him. He's classic.
Yeah. Freaking character, man. But, you know, you're right. I mean, Slash's Snake Pit, Slash had some pretty good material at this time, which isn't bad. That was pretty memorable. The Firehouse stuff, another 90s or 80s band trying to stay relevant in the 90s. You know, there was a lot of stuff that just really fell off the wayside. But I did have to make mention, you know, Dokken Dysfunctional and, you know, Skid Row, Subhuman Race, that was their the tail end of their Pantera influence period. You know, that was when they were doing the heavier stuff that they wanted to do. You know, you could tell that they were kindred spirits. You know, they did a lot of touring with, you know, Pantera off and on back in those days. So,
And Slash's Snake Pit did land the opening slot on that AC/DC Ballbreaker tour because I saw
it. Oh, yeah. That's
so,
right. Yeah.
So that was different because, you know, at the time it was like, oh, still Slash with his big top hat, but he's got his own group. It's not GNR. What is it? You know, but yeah.
And it had some edge though, man. It was some pretty cool stuff.
That's one of those albums that you look back in time and you say it didn't get the credit it deserved at the time, but it's not a bad album with a pretty good cast and musicians. Exactly. So that was the '80s. I mean, we got a couple more to cover. Another couple of albums just worth shouting out, giving a call out. Troubles, Plastic Greenhead, King Diamonds, awesome, the Spider Lullaby, both great albums, some awesome songs on those albums. Dream Theater put out a covers album called The Change of Seasons. And Ian, something that you liked was Cathedral's The Carnival Bazaar. So these are all really good, heavy albums, quality material from that period. One of the ones I wanted to talk about, and this was a favorite of mine from 1995, was, of course, being a big Black Sabbath fan, was Forbidden. Now, interesting you say that, Ian, because being the junkie I am, it's got a couple songs on there, but to me in general, it was a drop off from Tear and the Headless Cross. And I just don't think the songwriting was there. Really, I think the one great track on there is the last track, Kiss of Death. It was just a heavy, heavy track. But what made this one cool was, A, you had Ernie Chapman from Body Count that produced it. And then you had Ice-T do a guest appearance on Illusion of Power. They had this cartoon cover. But just like your experience with the Dokken Show, I saw this opening night at Toad's Place up in Hartford, Connecticut. And then, you know, at the beginning of the show, I said 1995 was about the mid 20s years where you're exploring your world. And I went backpacking with three of my best friends over to Europe for 3 weeks. And we planned one concert. And one of them we went to see, this tour in Hamburg, Germany. And it was great. Got some,
so you saw him twice.
Saw him twice, actually. And I saw him in New York as well. But we met Tony Martin. We met Bobby Rondinelli. We met basically the whole band, just not Tony Iommi. Got photos with all of them. Neil Murray. Yeah. And it was just great. That was my first time seeing a concert in another country. And I remember meeting up with an old tape trader named Hans Kern. The guy had more shit in his collection than I've ever seen, you know. But that's, you know, great memories of the tour, not such great memories of the album. What'd you think about it, Ian?
You're right. I mean, you know, some of the writing on it wasn't as good. But you'll never hear me say, you know what, Tony Iommi can't write a good riff.
Right.
Because, I mean, you know, he could fall out of bed, stub his toe and go, ah, and someone would be like, Tony, that's a great riff. And, you know, that could have been what he put on the album. But I you're right. Kiss of Death, though. Kiss of Death is such a freaking awesome song.
And they only did that. They played that song live in Europe, but not in the States. So I did get able to see it, which was great. So, but
Bill,
that was
you got any memories?
I just, when that album came out, I remember listening to it and not being too impressed with it at the time. And I think it was my mindset more than anything, because it really isn't that bad of a record. I mean, I listen to it now and I'm like, why didn't I like this back then?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But man, that's cool. You saw him twice on that tour.
Yeah.
Now, Toads, that's a club.
Yeah, it was. Yep. And then I saw him at the Roseland Ballroom in New York City. And then, Docks in Hamburg, Germany.
Oh, you saw him three times.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But nice. it was the second leg of the tour. So I saw him in the summertime in the US and then back in October in Europe.
In Europe.
So with Tiamat opening. Tiamat.
Oh, nice. Wow.
Yeah.
So Tiamat's a heavy band.
Yeah, nice. Exactly. Yeah. So I want to quickly talk about there's a short list I have of favorites, right? Just going to go through them quickly. Monster Magnet's Dopes to Affinity. I think that was the first time I heard those guys. And I said, wow, what sound is this? They're another band that, you know, you can't quite categorize them. They're heavy. They're a little bluesy. They got some almost retro, like weird late 60s vibe to them. And yet they're out there. And this is a classic album, man. I think that's one that put them on the map. One worth hitting a listen. Richie Blackmore's Stranger in Us All. It was the last album he put out, the studio album. Flew under the radar, had Doogie White on vocals, Greg Smith on bass, and a few other guys. You know, that was another show. He played limited shows in the States. He toured, played the Burchill. It was the one and only time, based on my age, I was able to see Rainbow. So, decent album. And Primus's Tales from the Punch Bowl. Wynonna's Big Brown Beaver. Listen, they were arena status at this point. So
you're right. They were. Yes.
Played,
they were.
Played Nassau Coliseum. That's how big they were on this album. So, and on the Megadeth connection, Bill, I know you got yelled at by Dave Mustaine, but I always liked that album, Hidden Treasures. A couple covers, Paranoid, No More Mr. Nice Guy. They had Go to Hell off of Bill and Ted's Bogus Adventure. You know, 99 Ways to Die. Pretty good stuff.
Yeah, I think that 99 Ways to Die was probably one of the last real good ones, because when they came out later, and you know, I don't know, I'm back and forth with Megadeth when it comes to some of their material, you know, but I'm the same way. I've said it before, every one of the big four I'm back and forth with, you know, the Load and Reload stuff. There's like a handful of stuff I like, and there's the rest of it is just shit.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. That middle period with Slayer. Yep. Don't like it. And Anthrax, we discussed it, you know, here with the albums. I like their stuff as a whole a lot more, but they still have a lot of stuff in there where it's like, hey, you know what? You could have taken this album to pull these songs out, put these songs together and made one great album. You know, with better production, but it's. But this is. Go ahead. Go right ahead.
No, I was going to.
Well, I was going to say I'd be remiss if we don't talk about the one band that Verno would not want us to talk about, and it's an album that I think we all may have some mixed feelings about. It's Balance by Van Halen. Now, I personally like the album. It was, there was a darker mood to the album than For Unlawful Carnal Knowledge. Mm-hmm. But it kind of sit perfect at this time. Like, you know, when we were talking, you know, the Down album was a huge influence on me, you know, and that got a lot of spins. Balance got a lot of spins too, you know, because it was Eddie. I'm not going to throw away Eddie just because, you know, he's with Sammy, and, you know, I mean, I was still listening to it, not as adamantly as I would, you know, Roth era stuff. But, I mean, there's a lot of good songs on here. And I think that, you know, it's a period of time that, you know, people quickly forget because they did the one, you know, tour, you mm-hmm. know, with Sammy following this. And then, you know, there was a big pissing match, and they decided to get Dave back in the band and do the MTV, was it 96, the VMAs, right?
Yep.
When they did the reunion for the greatest hits. So,
this is another example, guys. Van Halen put a string of albums together with Sammy Hagar that went on for about 10 years, and one was just bigger than the next, right? And it's hard to sustain that. And this kind of came towards the end, but again, Seven Seal, great song. Can't Stop Loving You was your MTV hit. I thought Amsterdam was just a killer track. Dry Live, Al's drums in that were killer. Like, great tour. Like, you know, it's just another one. They just kept coming back and back and back. Eddie at this point had the short haircut, wearing the sunglasses on the back cover, right? Like, different look. But, you know, again, not the favorite, but definitely some good, strong material there. But very hard to maintain a career like that where you put one album after the next. You're not going to hit a home run every time.
No. Bill?
Yeah, I mean, I felt like they were kind of, when that album came out, I thought they were kind of going through the motions. But in hindsight, it is a good record. It's a solid record. You know, I Can't Stop Loving You, that was the hit.
The big hit, yeah.
Like, I remember not liking that song then, but if you watch that video now, it's a good tune. It's a lighthearted, you know, feel good song, I guess.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And you know, to your credit too, Amsterdam, badass song. You know, that's that trilogy that they had. They had Summer Nights, they had Cabo Wabo, and they had Amsterdam. And it's like those this is the new party music that Van Halen puts out, you know, when they put out those kinds of songs. It's really fun stuff, you know, and that's why I enjoyed it, because it still had that fun Van Halen vibe to it, you know, even though it was the darker 90s, you know, period. It was still really good.
So, Bill, you got yelled at by Dave Mustaine, and on my way out to Jones Beach to see this tour, the Van Halen tour, I got pulled over with my friend Matt Clary on the I think it was the Southern State Parkway, and we were stuck in traffic, and I had to take a really bad piss, and this big black state trooper pulls me over, checks the car, says, "Where's the beer? You guys have been drinking." Pull aside, and I said, "There's no beer in this car." And he looked through the car, and it was nothing but Gatorades and waters. And he looked at me, he says, "I was certain you guys were drinking and driving." He goes, "Because you ran so fast over to take a piss by the interstate. I said, "We came from Jersey, 2 hours in traffic. It's hot out. It's the summer. I had to take a piss." He laughed and he said, "Get back in the car and go enjoy the show." So that was a memory I had from that tour.
Nice.
But
that's cool.
At least he let you go.
Exactly. Guys, we could go on all day. I think we've covered a lot of ground here in 1995. You know, lots of other albums. If, for you, the listeners, explore. Check out some of the other ones we didn't talk about today. Sabotage's Dead, Winter Dead, Saxon's Dogs of War, releases from Uriah Heep, and even maybe the one we're going to leave with, Ian, is one we can't forget about because it set the tone for the second half of the 90s and the 2000s to come. And that would be Rob Zombie's Astro Creep 2000, right? Oh, this was the sound of metal to come go forward. Right. More human than more human. It was on the radio every 2 seconds, probably the number one rock song at that time. It dominated radio. These guys are big. They're headlining in a second slot on Ozfest, and they're still out there as the first bill. Every one of these big Sonic Temple tours and everything like else. And this was the sound of metal go forward.
Yeah. And the sad part about it is this was like the demise of White Zombie, as you would know it. You know, they did the one remix album that they did afterwards, you know, and then Rob basically ended up becoming a solo artist. But this album, I mean, there's a lot of great stuff on this album. You know, it's heavy as hell. You know, I mean, and to, you know, like to what Bill was saying with, you know, like when you listen to that Fear Factory Demanufacture album, there's a lot of industrial stuff that Rob was throwing on at this time period. You know, I mean, all of the old, you know, B movie, you know, footage, you know, the women being whipped and they're moaning and
late
stuff.
Late 60s
in the background.
Stuff. Yep.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of that stuff that gets put in, you know, and all the synthesizer music. So it definitely is that new metal, like you were saying, you know, that comes around or that came around at this time. So Bill, do you have any fond?
Yeah, my memory from that album, unfortunately, is a bad one.
Uh-oh. I don't like it either, Bill. I'm with you.
No. Okay. I it's not that I don't like the album. To me, I don't know. I mean, it's okay. But I did see them on that tour. I went and saw them in Tampa, and good show. They put on a great show. And I'm leaving, and I walk out the door, and I hear a pop, and I look over, and I see a woman falling to the ground with blood coming out of her head. So it turns out she was shot in the head by her ex-husband.
What?
And, yeah.
That's a freaking way to end a show. Holy shit.
Yeah, it was pretty awful. So that's my terrible memory of that record. So
now that would ruin it for me too. My God. The one thing I wanted to point out too, you know, just real quick, you know, we talked about it with Motorhead and we talked about it with a lot of the bands from the 80s, but you know, the Saxon Dogs of War and the Uriah Heep Sea of Light. This is that period where those old school bands started making heavier music again, you know, cool, heavier music.
Yeah.
And the stuff that with both of those bands, Uriah Heep and Saxon, has sustained up through now. Yep. You know, they still
put out a great Uriah Heep record, by the way. That album kicks ass.
Yep. It is. You know, and so I think that anybody that follows our show should, you know, along with all the other suggestions we've given, you know, should go check that stuff out too, because I mean, that's, it's definitely, you can see that it's like, oh yeah, you could tell where it started, you know, and now all of a sudden you bring it up to now. So good stuff. This was another fun year, guys.
Absolutely. We still have four more years in the decade to come. So,
you know, it was definitely a better year than, like, when I think of the 90s, they're kind of a blur to me because I was living in Florida, which I'm back in Florida, but right. Florida was a blur at the time. And but now when, you know, going through these records, I have some good memories, you know, and some bad ones. But the bad one wasn't anyone's, not my fault. But, you know, it was a good time, though. Good time to be a youngster in the heavy metal.
Absolutely. Sure. Well,
Go ahead.
I was saying that's the perfect way to put it. And we all have good memories from this year, you know, some good fun concert stories and meetups with different artists. Really good stuff to reminisce.
Well, and I think that, you know, like Walt and I had said before, you know, I mean, the one thing that's good about this whole series is the fact that it gives everybody a chance to be a little nostalgic. You know, because a lot of times, you know, there's things that you may have forgotten or you missed, and you get to go back and check it out after we give you the suggestions. So hopefully everybody that's paying attention to the show will do that. But, you know, I mean, I got to tell you, I shocked myself when I went back and listened to Subhuman Race again. I was like, Jesus, I forgot how heavy this album actually is. And it's really a heavy album. And not their best album that by far means, but it's still a really heavy album for Skid Row anyways. So,
well, guys, it's been a pleasure. And for the listeners, just a reminder, get up to the metalmayhemroc.com. Join our community by signing up for our newsletter. This is our way to alert you about new podcast episodes, YouTube interviews, and reminders for our live radio show Monday nights on Metal Devastation Radio. Again, that's metalmayhemroc.com. For my metal brothers, Ian O'Rourke and Bill the Rager, this is Metal Walt.
Keep raging.
See ya!
Metal for life.
Thank you for listening to Metal Mayhem ROC. Check out our website at metalmayhemroc.com for information on podcasts, archives, links to all our live radio shows.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.